Welcome to Sound Mind, a podcast about physician wellness and medical culture. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline Gérin-Lajoie. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has triggered many emotions and reactions in the medical community. The invasion has created more than 4.5 million refugees so far. More than half of them have crossed into neighboring Poland in search of shelter and safety. On this episode, we're going to explore why two Canadian doctors, one from Vancouver, the other from Hamilton, volunteered to assist at one of those border crossings. Dr. Anthony Fong is an emergency physician and clinical assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Daniel Kolick is also an emergency physician and assistant clinical professor of emergency medicine at McMaster University. Both men traveled to Ukraine as part of Canadian Medical Assistance Teams, or CMAT, provides international humanitarian assistance and is run by volunteers and funded by donors. Doctors Fong and Kolick recently returned from Ukraine. Thank you both so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Anthony, this was not your first time volunteering for an international assistance mission, but what made you decide to go to a war zone?
Carolyn, I didn't really expect to be deployed at first because, as you alluded to, CMAT has lots of experience in disaster zones in terms of natural disasters, but this is the first time they were really going as a deployment to a war zone. And so when I first heard about the deployment, I was actually in Mexico on a vacation, and I got a message from the executive director saying, hey guys, there's a call out for this. And I didn't seriously think it would actually happen, but I was just interested because it was all over the news at that point in time. And then when I returned, basically we're on standby, which is a state in disaster deployment where you set everything aside, you ask around to get people to take your shifts just in case you have to go. And then once you get the green light to go, then you usually have to deploy within 48 hours. And so I was ready this whole time in terms of, or I was getting ready. And then once that green light went, I was like, I guess it's happening. And you just pick up your stuff and leave. And so it wasn't planned. It was just a spur of the moment decision.
Daniel, you have a lot of experience in disaster response through your role as chair of the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians Disaster Committee. But this was your first experience with an international crisis. Tell us how the decision to go to Ukraine came about for you.
Well, there are two sides to this. One is that my experience and knowledge base have always been on the receiving end at hospitals and so on, because that's what emergency physicians do. My hidden guilty secret was I had never deployed as an away team. So part of this was for myself. I really felt that I needed to make sure I understood and experienced it myself. But on a much deeper level, I was watching what was going on, and my family escaped World War II in Europe. And I really can't expect anybody else to stand up and help if I'm not willing to do it myself. And at the time, people didn't. So I think I have an obligation to stand up and help others now.
You both ended up at the same location in Ukraine, and we will walk through the story of how you got there. But first, did you know each other before this mission?
Nope.
First time we're meeting.
We met as roommates when we landed the first night. We crashed together.
And there was an instant bond and connection.
Totally. We're both coming from opposite sides of the country, but I think it was immediately apparent that we're on the same page in terms of we're both there to do good, and we both have some experience in terms of disaster medicine.
I think the fact that there's a common mission creates a common kinship right away, because we all really want to do the same thing and we're motivated to work together.
Anthony, can you walk us through the journey of getting to that Poland-Ukraine border? What was that like?
The journey, Carolyn, was all but smooth. I think the minute we landed, our first task really as a medical deployment was to find the most appropriate site with the highest need for medical care for refugees. So we were at first operating off basically a tip that I had gotten from a Quebec doctor who had set up clinic by a border site called Pribene in Poland. Like, it's on the Polish side, just meters away from the border. And this physician, Dr. Ogier, had set up a clinic and had been operating it almost single-handedly for 2 weeks before we arrived. And so the night before I left for Poland, I was talking to him on Facebook. I didn't know this gentleman beforehand. I just basically saw him on the news. And I was like, how are things going there? And he responded, I need help. Please come and lend a hand, because after I leave, there's nobody. It's just me. And he had one other colleague, but that colleague had been away for a couple days in a row. And so our first task was to assess that site. And that site turned out to be quite a mishmash of different NGOs competing for the space. And it ended up being quite an adventure trying to negotiate between different players on who was going to do what and who was best suited to run a clinic there. And so we ended up deciding that wasn't the site to set up. And so we had to choose another site. So that delayed us by a couple days. We then got hooked up with Polish Medical Mission, and which is this NGO run out of Warsaw. And through them, we found another site on the Ukraine side called Krakowice, and we ended up setting up there and on the Ukraine side.
The setup there was an interesting experience because we wanted to be sure we're doing something that is meaningful and that is helpful. So a team of three of us went out there on basically an exploratory move. And we realized that what's happening there is there had been an ambulance put there with some paramedic students, but they were just basically parked outside of the flow of people. And they'd had 6 fatalities in the prior week to 10 days. So what we realized was that there's room for us to position ourselves literally in the flow of the refugees, so nobody could get by without our actually seeing them. Not obstructive, but we were just there. And that worked beautifully, because as the buses came by, we could see everybody coming in. We knew we could spot somebody who was sick, and they could see us. Because before, if they didn't know where the ambulance was, they wouldn't know to go for help. And if the ambulance didn't know there was a problem, they wouldn't know how to connect. So we actually put ourselves in the stream, and that worked beautifully.
Daniel, can you describe a little bit more about the scene at the medical setup?
Sure. Buses would pull up with refugees from a variety of places. The majority we saw were from Kharkiv and from Mariupol. They would unload people at the bottom of this long ramp that they would walk up to, and they would come into a tent. It was a large white rectangular tent. And as they were coming in, there would be announcements made on a loudspeaker telling them that you're here, you can stay warm, you can charge your phones, because everybody had phones. That's how they stayed in touch with each other as the families were separated. There was food, there was coffee, tea, and so on. And so they would come on in, they would warm themselves up, they would stop for a while. As they came in, we were right at the entrance, so they could see. We had signs up in Ukrainian saying that it was a free medical clinic, and so they would come to us if they had concerns, and if we saw someone who looked distressed, then we could reach out to them. They would spend a bit of time in the tent, and then they would move on from there to another staging area just before crossing the border, which they would cross on foot. And then at the other side, once they got across, there would be buses picking them up and taking them to further stations in Poland. And the nature of this is that people moved in boluses. There would be a busload would arrive, a busload would get picked up the other end, and then they would shift through as a mass of people, and then the next bus would arrive and fill the tent again.
Were you able to speak the language?
I can take that one. So the answer is, the quick answer is no. So CMAT had provided us, or we, as part of our team, we had Natalia Halich, who is Ukrainian-Canadian and was, you know, able to speak Ukrainian and Russian and English. So she acted as our interpreter for the first couple of days. And then after that, she had to leave early because she had commitments back in Toronto. And after that, we had a combination of different actors, different very generous volunteers from various places, almost randomly offered to help us interpret. Two of these interpreters were from the Jewish Messianic congregation of Kyiv, and they had set up a tent just across the street from our large white welcome tent and our medical clinic. And they wandered by one day while Natalia was interpreting for us, and they asked, hey, do you need help? And we soon became pretty tight. They spent a couple of days with us. And these are people who have jobs. During the week, they have to go back to Lviv and work. And then on weekends, they join us and they act as interpreters. And we also had an interpreter from another partner NGO, Katya Trusova, who came from Texas. She's Ukrainian, but she's living in Texas. And she joined us for a few days as well. And her story is very interesting. Her mother is actually from Kherson, which is a town in the southern part of Ukraine. And her mother at that point in time was actually trapped in that area of Ukraine. And so Katya came to Ukraine in order to help people in general. But her heart, of course, was in her hometown, hoping that her mom would get out.
Daniel, can you talk to us about some of the medical cases that you were seeing?
Sure. The vast majority of what we saw was primary care. In the time I was there, I only saw one trauma patient directly related to warfare. That was a patient who had shrapnel wounds that were at this point 2 days old, and he really just wanted a dressing change because he had to keep going. As we'd mentioned earlier, their goal is to get to Poland. It's not to see me. So as long as he was safe, which he was, we redressed that and had him go for more definitive care in Poland. Most of what I saw were things like headache, nausea, vomiting, people who were on buses for 30 hours or worse for the wear. We had a lot of people who had underlying illnesses that were not being treated, primarily hypertension, where they ran out of meds, some cardiac patients who had some chest pain, and a lot of anxiety, which is quite reasonable. And I remember having some discussions with people who saw that their blood pressure was higher than usual and they were worried. And I would tell them, this is not a normal situation. For you to have a normal blood pressure now would be worrisome. The fact that you have a bit of an elevated blood pressure is probably pretty adaptive. And just to reassure them, because they had very solid reasons to be anxious.
How well resourced were you to help and do your work?
I think we were quite well resourced and we were adaptive. When it came to delivering the basics of primary care, again, dressings, assessments, basic meds, antibiotics, anti-nauseants, all the things we needed, we had what we needed. Where we sometimes would be challenged is patients would show up with their last three tablets for some sort of hypertension or cardiovascular issue. And a lot of them were on these combined medications. So we would figure out the Cyrillic and see, well, this is a beta blocker and this is something else. And we'd come up to the closest approximation we could get and give them at least a day or two supply so they could manage to get into Poland and get their original drug. But we really were, I found, quite well supplied. We weren't designed or intended to treat acute trauma. So from that viewpoint, we didn't need that.
During this experience, were either of you ever concerned for your own safety?
It's always at the back of your mind. So from the very first couple of days, we installed apps on our phones that were air raid alarm apps that were in Cyrillic script. And we basically, the app would simulate an air siren whenever an air siren actually went off in the Lviv Oblast region of Ukraine. And I remember the very first time I heard an air siren, we were in our guest house in, I think it was Tomashev, and it was just jarring. It was really a wake-up call, literally, because it happened in the middle of the night. It was like 3:30 a.m., as they tend to happen. And it really made real what was potentially, you know, a risk. And we would, after a while, we would just get used to it because these air raid sirens, they just went off on a nightly basis, usually between 3:30 and 5 a.m. And usually they were false alarms that were canceled very quickly, but sometimes the alarm would go off and it wouldn't be canceled, and you would just be waiting a couple hours just for something to happen, and we would just stay awake. You know, I was on the night shift for three nights in a row, and we would just stay awake. We had the option of sleeping because sometimes it wasn't that busy, but sometimes you just can't sleep through something like that. So it's always in the back of your mind that something could happen, even though probably we're okay. It's all, nothing comes without a little bit of risk in the disaster response game.
The decision to go to Ukraine comes at the end of 2 long years of the pandemic. How would you gauge your wellness as a physician here in Canada during COVID-19?
Fluctuating wildly. I would say at the very beginning of the pandemic, March 2020, there was almost no other time in my career where I felt like I was needed more than in that first month or two. Because there was so much to learn and things were changing all the time and all the media was pointing towards COVID-19 as a story, as something that in every aspect of society. And so we went through this kind of roller coaster of emotions. And sometime last summer, I found that I wanted to do something a bit different with my career, because it just seemed that there was no end in sight in terms of working in what I would say it's pretty difficult conditions, having to work in masks with a lot of people that you might have not seen the other half of their face ever before. I'm sure lots of people in the healthcare profession can identify with that kind of situation. So in September of 2021, I decided to pursue journalism. So I signed up for a fellowship at University of Toronto. And I cut down my shifts to part-time. So I think the journey to answer that question of what do you find meaningful in your career, I think it's constantly changing. And I think it's natural to question that at least every few years. If you're doing the same thing for a year, I'm the kind of personality where I've got to change something after a while, because I find that just the reward centers of my brain, they stop firing, and my ability to stay in that same sphere, doing that same practice, it plateaus.
What about for you, Daniel?
I'm constantly reminded of the fact that I am an older physician and Anthony is a younger physician, because I had just gone down to half time before COVID happened. And then, of course, I found myself at time and a half. We sort of went from, at the beginning, it wasn't panic, but it was this level of we've got to get things in place. And through CAPE, through the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians, and through another group, the Center for Excellence in Emergency Preparedness, we started putting out guidelines once or twice a week on how to organize your emergency department, how to divide into hot zones, cold zones, how to flow people through. A first set of at least general orders you can use to assess patients. We were churning out information, and so you really don't have time to get panicky if you're exhausted. So you just kept on working at stuff. And that, to me, was my way, at least emotionally, of coping with what we were seeing, the stuff coming out of Italy. And that was terrifying. And then at least I was worried about bringing anything home. So we would change at work and shower at work. And anyone felt vaguely unwell, we're not going near our family. So that was at the beginning. And then, as with everything else, you acclimatize. And after a while, it became, oh, I've got to put a mask on again. And I really cannot see through this face shield. And I am sweating like crazy under this gown. And so it became irritating, which is probably a sign of adapting to it.
On this podcast series, we've heard how clerical work or the admin burden of medicine can often erode the sense of meaning physicians derive from taking care of their patients. How is the experience different in Ukraine and Poland?
It was wonderful. And in the sense that you could focus on not only what we felt to be important, but what we got into medical school for in the first place. nobody joins medical school with the intent of doing more charting. It's, you will never see someone saying, why are you going to medical school? I just want a chart. That doesn't happen. And what came to mind was there was a period when the emergency physicians in my hospital were also running cardiac arrests before we had a dedicated arrest team. And when the arrest call would go out, suddenly you had total clarity. You had total priorities. This is the one thing I have to think about. And every other burden was taken away from you. And in a way, the arrests were some of the most relaxing times, as odd as it sounds, because from that viewpoint, I didn't think about anything else. I'm focused on one task only, and it is the task I trained for, as opposed to all the other stuff that exhausts us that we were never trained for and that is constantly changing. Medicine doesn't change anywhere near as fast as the computer systems we have to adapt to deliver the medicine. So I found it liberating not to have to focus that much. We did have to do charting. That's part of the WHO standards, but it was focused on important things and not 10 million demographics that don't really change patient outcome.
And what about for you, Anthony? Did you find more meaning in the work in Ukraine?
I wouldn't say I found more meaning in the work in Ukraine in terms of EMR as a distraction from your actual work, just by virtue of the fact that when I was working, I was the one that was doing most of the charting. And our EMR was, as usual with EMRs, I think this norm is that they're not particularly user-friendly as a rule. So this one was no exception. But, you know, you get it down pat and it becomes less of a distraction. But I agree with Daniel in terms of when things hit the fan, having that burden of immediate charting removed is a huge weight off my shoulders. And just to know that everyone is communicating with words, looking each other in the eye, and everything I'm saying is being listened to in terms of orders are being given, orders are being heard. We are asking each other about what you think about this situation. We are getting a consensus about what we should do. One example comes to mind in the field in Krakowets that I recently wrote about in the news. So one of these cases was a case of a young man, 27-year-old from Kharkiv, who basically his mother presented to our medical clinic at 1 a.m. in tears. And she told us that her son was having a seizure in her tent. So one thing you need to know about Krakowets is that there's a tent city set up there. It's a hodgepodge of various NGOs set up offering supports, and also families that can't necessarily cross the border immediately. Maybe there is some problem with their documentation, or maybe they just think that's the safest place for them to be at that point in time. So one of our most experienced emerge nurses and our interpreter went across the street to this tent, and we entered this tiny circular tent, and we found that there are about a dozen people standing inside, and their eyes were all fixated on this one 27-year-old man, and he was indeed having a seizure. And we didn't have any of the burdens of charting in the way then. It was just assessment, making a plan together. We had determined that we were going to put him in recovery position. Brandon, one of our experienced nurses, he went to get a wheelchair, and we made a plan to evacuate him out of the tent and then get into an ambulance and after a quick assessment. And so we did that and we brought him to the tent. It just so happened he kept on seizing. We couldn't find the problem. It wasn't his blood sugar. We had no lab support, so we needed to call the Ukrainian ambulance. And then afterwards, the ambulance arrived, gave him some injection of benzodiazepines to stop his seizures, and they transport him to a hospital. And the closest hospital was in Lviv, about 70 kilometers away. And throughout that whole time, it's not like we were charting everything that we were doing. Everything's just, you're scribbling down things on a napkin in terms of vital signs, and you're just talking to each other as a team, and that charting stuff can happen later. So I found that experience quite meaningful because we provided emergency care in a setting that was really needed. If we left him in that tent, he probably would have died. And we didn't have all the bells and whistles of what you might find in an urban emerge in downtown Vancouver. but it doesn't matter. All that matters in that case, in that situation, is that you're communicating as a team and doing as much as you can.
Thank you. Anthony said something that really resonated with me, and that was that we were talking to each other. The communication was person to person and not person to computer to person. There was a moment when I was seeing some patients and I was working with another very experienced nurse, Teresa, and I listened to the person's lungs and I was saying out loud, there's some crackles here, and she heard it and she's already pulling the meds because she knows what I'm going to do. And she just looked at me and I didn't say anything. I just nodded. And that's all. And that level of communication is far more complex and far deeper than what we do normally. And it's much more emotionally satisfying.
So Daniel, now that you're back in Canada, has the experience rejuvenated your sense of meaning or purpose?
It's certainly charged my batteries. It's certainly reminded me of the fact that what I am doing is helping people in a meaningful way. It also gave me a reminder that we are phenomenally fortunate, not only because we're away from war, but because of all the resources we have. So all that context is important. So from that viewpoint, it certainly was rejuvenating.
And Anthony, given that this was your first experience in a conflict zone, how did it impact you?
Well, I think In this case, I was lucky enough to learn by doing and learn by being thrown into play, is so to speak. And I think it gave me a new appreciation for disaster medicine, disaster response, and humanitarianism as a whole, as a discipline. And because it does require discipline, you have to have your standards, you have to have a strong code of ethics. And by the way, that code of ethics is in writing. There's the Sphere Guide, which is a guide online that has a very good recommended ethical code that one should follow if you're going to do humanitarian work. And I think just watching on the ground great examples of that happening and also watching very poor examples of that happening all at the same time, all during one deployment, I think it really struck me as something that's very important to promote in terms of, yeah, it's a discipline. And lots of people have asked me since they realized that I went to Ukraine and Poland for 2 weeks, what can I do to help? And this experience has changed how I would answer that question. Because, Carolyn, over in Poland and Ukraine, there are very well-meaning and some very good, effective NGOs on the ground there. But at the same time, we did see a lot of ineffective humanitarianism, or even humanitarianism that gets in the way. Examples of people showing up alone without any logistical support. Examples of people taking each other's things. We had some boxes of our medications stolen. We did not know the purpose of the theft. There were people competing for space to do humanitarian work. And there was just a lack of coordination that we saw there that happens in lots of disaster zones, but it's definitely the first time that I've seen it on such a scale. And so it renews my interest in this field as a whole and gives me a lot of work because I really want to learn as much as I can in the next few months, and especially if I decide to go again on a similar deployment or any other disaster response deployment.
Daniel, what would you say to a physician who may be searching for meaning outside their day-to-day work? Would you recommend this type of experience?
I'd recommend doing something that you feel has meaning. This type of experience is one example, but I think the same thing could be achieved by working with the homeless. The same thing could be achieved by working with people who are otherwise disadvantaged, by working with refugees who come to your community. There are a lot of people who need our help, and we are certainly, as emergency physicians, uniquely qualified to cross across broad swaths of medicine at an intensive primary care level and help a lot of people. You don't have to go halfway across the world to do it.
Thank you both for sharing your experiences with us, and thank you for the important work that you do.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Thanks, Carolyn, so much. It's been a pleasure being on your show.
Dr. Anthony Fong is an emergency physician in Vancouver, and Dr. Daniel Kolick is an emergency physician based in Hamilton. SoundMind is produced by Podcraft Productions. If you're looking for resources, tools, and research on the topics covered today, please visit the CMA Physician Wellness Hub at cma.ca. We'd love to hear what you think of SoundMind. Please consider giving us a rating or review through your favorite listening platform. I'm Dr. Caroline Gérin-Lajoie. Thank you for listening.